I can see it now, tripping on split stones, trying to make hits so we can play them loud. That's Maggie Rogers. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Blue Jays kind of tripped their way to a big split with the Baltimore Orioles, a tight 6-5 series finale victory on Thursday. They will try to keep those hits coming with a 3-set in Oakland and a chance to, for the first time since mid-April, sneak back above 500 before the schedule of the rest of June turns very, very dark and difficult. Fun one yesterday. They just hung on 6-5, big three-run homer from Vlad. Actually had some insurance runs. Terrific outing from Yusei Kikuchi. And yeah, a little bit of a shaky bullpen day, but that's a really good Orioles lineup, and you managed to hang on. So the Jays are now back up to 30-32. Again, split with the Orioles coming into this series. You would have been happy with that. Weird the way it happened. Always a little awkward to get blown out for two and then win 2 1-run games, but they won those 2 1-run games. They are in a pretty okay spot here heading into Oakland where, yeah, if you sweep, not only do you have your first 5-game winning streak of the season, but you head into the Cleveland, Boston, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Yankees part of your schedule the rest of the way, a little above 500, a little more back in the periphery of that playoff mix, where, by the way, they're only 3 games out. The new format's so funny that you can have 2 very, very bad months of baseball and still be like, yeah, we're a stone's throw from the playoffs. A loaded show for you today. We'll talk to Justin Choi of Fangraphs, who had a really great piece this week on why so many pitchers are adding a second type of fastball now, why there are more Chris Bassetts emerging in the league, guys who throw 4+ pitches to try to keep hitters off their fastball as we see four-seam usage decrease around the league. We'll talk to Pat Malacaro, voice of the Buffalo Bisons, and we'll keep an eye on the newswire because Spencer Horwitz got pulled from the Buffalo Bisons game last night, and there was no word of an injury or anything like that. Just something to keep an eye on. We'll also talk to Melissa Lockard of The Athletic. She is Oakland-based. Tonight, the Jays will play Oakland. It is reverse boycott night. So as the Oakland fan base continues to push back against the way John Fisher has treated that team, John Fisher's their owner. He's obviously trying to move them to Sacramento and then eventually to Las Vegas. This is the big community rally. And yeah, you've got to give them a little bit of money to get in the door. But this is it was very cool last year when they did it. The sell the team chance and things like that. We'll get to see that firsthand tonight, 9:40 start. Let's break down what happened in that Orioles series. Let's set up this weekend. Let's talk to our number one guy, Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Keegan, happy Friday. How we doing, man?
I'm doing well, Blake. How you doing?
I'm good, man. It's, again, nicer to do this show after coming up with those couple wins. And nice to finally have you on after good Blue Jays baseball. I feel like we've just been, like, you have come on after the, and we schedule these several days in advance, so it's not like I'm just hitting Keegan up like, oh, things are bad, I got to get to Keegan. It's just worked out that way. We've got some positives to talk about today.
We got lucky. You know, I started covering this team in 2017, too, right after everything good happened, so I've long felt like the kiss of death in this market, so it's nice to be able to talk about some wins. Wins or losses don't matter to me covering a team, but feeling refreshed does. And you can only write the same story so many times. So it's a little different these last couple of days. And a big split sounds like you're trying to find a silver lining, but really no. After those first 2 games, those were a total mess. So to come back from those, big for now. Ideally, you're winning some series, but really big to save those. Because, Blake, if they had dropped 1 or 2 more of those, we're having a way different conversation today.
We are. And then you're going into Oakland, and even if they sweep, it's like, okay, well, look at what you've done against Oakland, the White Sox, Pittsburgh. But once you even reach the tier of the Tigers, you couldn't get it done. You certainly couldn't get it done against Baltimore. And I know that there are probably some fans and some segments of the fan base who think, you know, getting a split against Baltimore is lowering the bar a little too far. To that, I would say, it is a realistic appraisal of where this team is at, where at the start of the season, yes, you would have looked at the schedule and you would have been like, 4 at home against Baltimore, you got to take 3 from that. You got to show you're on their level, and if you're hosting the series, but they're not on that level. They're a tier down. So, you know, you are kind of, you know, if we're being realistic, they're punching up at the Orioles. So taking 2 is pretty solid. So not to overdo the size of 1 or 2 games, we've been pretty dismissive when we talk this year about, hey, they had that one good win, they had that one good series, will it roll? They do have the benefit of rolling into Oakland after this, and that's a pretty iffy Oakland A's team. But more to the Baltimore side of this, because again, I don't think we were going to feel unless they get swept by the A's, like, I don't think we're going to feel too big one way or the other about this. How big do those two wins feel? Especially, I know you were in the clubhouse afterward, and, you know, the guys seemed pretty rallied around coming back to get that split.
Yeah, these wins, Blake, in this series, for me, wasn't even as much about the numbers or exactly the fine points of what happened, but it's really about measuring yourself up against a team like Baltimore. This is more than just a division rival. This is an example of who the Blue Jays want to be. This is who the Blue Jays thought they were going to be. Go back to 2019, 2020. They thought that they were going to be the division-dominating team built on internal homegrown talent. That's the Orioles now. The Orioles have whizzed right past them. It has not been subtle. Everybody sees it. So there is a bit of a big brother, little brother dynamic. Right now, the Orioles are the big brother, and they'd like to stay there. But this does run a little bit deeper, I think, for the Blue Jays with the Orioles. If I had to pick a rival within the division, it's probably the Orioles. You know, nobody's punched anybody lately. It doesn't run too deep. But it feels like this Orioles team is who they have to measure up against. And being able to come back and grab a couple is huge, because those first two games looked like that big brother, little brother dynamic in the worst possible way for the Blue Jays. So to be able to come back, get this on track going into Oakland is big, because like you said off the top, Blake, in the current wild card format, which I do not always love, if you try, you're probably going to have a shot at the postseason in late August and September. As long as you do not completely blow up your season, you got a shot. So the Blue Jays need to get this rolling into a tougher part of their schedule right now. And more than anything, they need a legitimate run. I feel like there have been so many failures to launch already this season. Oh, a few wins happen here. Is this it? No. Is this it? No. It's happening over and over. Maybe this is the one. We'll see. But every time you see them get one or two wins here, I think Blue Jays fans are more cautious by the week, but cautiously hoping that there's some sort of run left in this team beyond just two or three games that kind of trick you.
Yeah, and it's a great point. And look, we don't want to have the football pulled out on us again and bite on that, but it is a little different when you win two close games against the Orioles. And look, there is the reality of this series that the Orioles beat the brakes off you twice and then you narrowly won two games. That is, you know, big picture. You know, that we talked about this. John Schneider got asked about run differential the other day. That matters, projecting forward and evaluating everything, but you got the split, and those are in the standings now, and you have the chance to put a win streak together. After the game, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who got double Gatorade or Powerade, whatever brand they use these days, dumped on him because he was the big hitter instead of the guy throwing the water afterward, seemed very positive about that, but also said, not comfortable. And at 30 and 32, they absolutely should not be comfortable. But Vlad is a guy who generally, that's, you know, that's Mr. Positivity. That's Mr. Rah-Rah. That's, you know, he is, and this is a positive. He's able to, you know, find the fun in baseball when things aren't going that well as well. How important do you think it is that he is a voice now stepping up and saying, yeah, we won two games. I hit a big 3-run home run. That was a good win, but not enough right now.
That matters coming from Vladdy, because he does not usually say much publicly. And that's okay. Making my job easy is not his job. That's all right. But for example, Blake, just before that quote, I asked Vladdy, you know, these last few weeks have been much better for you. What feels better? And he said, well, some things are just falling in. I thank God it's working out.
Cool.
Okay, well, there's obviously more going on there. But that is totally up to him, and that's fine. But to hear Vladdy talk on bigger team issues, and I've been in every scrum this guy's done for 5 years, it's not as common. It's not as common for him to be as forceful or direct in conversations like that. And I think that is a very good thing. And for Vladdy to say that he's not comfortable is important in all of this, because I know that a lot of fans, it is easy for them to see Vladdy celebrating and enjoying the game and misconstrue that as a guy not taking it seriously. He does. I've seen the guy after losses. They hurt him. I've seen him after wins. They lift him up. He cares. It just looks different than some other guys. But for him to publicly talk like that, I think it's a good thing. I think we'll see Vladdy grow into that slowly over the years, whether here or somewhere else. We'll see. But I've noticed some growth from Vladdy in that sense. And that's what the Blue Jays need more of. You heard it with Isaiah Kiner-Falefa the day before, talking about, you know, our pitchers deserve more runs. We're not giving them enough. Some stuff that as I'm standing there holding a microphone, I'm thinking, exactly, there it is. Somebody's saying it. And to have that come from IKF is one thing. He's a guy I really respect, have come to really respect. But from Vladdy, that's a totally different ballgame. He's the face of all this. He has to be. And if he is not comfortable, then nobody's comfortable is probably the best way to say it.
And, I mean, it's a great point about adding more runs. You look at this game and you think back to the last time Kikuchi faced the Orioles, and that was the game where he only went 4 1/3, but he had good strikeout stuff. You know, Jimmy Garcia had that really big moment out of the bullpen, but they were never able to add on insurance runs. So when Adley Rutschman hits a late inning home run, that's a walk-off for the Orioles. Yesterday, the Jays get the 3 early. Kikuchi gives them a very good outing, but they're actually able to add insurance runs there, which it turns out were very, very valuable because you look ahead to the 9th inning, and I guess it was Ryan O'Hearn in this case. Adley's came in the 8th, but this is a very good Baltimore team. You can't presume you're going to win a 3-1 game against them. So it was nice to see that. I also take a little bit, I'm a mark for this, but like when a lot of bloop hits are falling in for you in good sequence, I kind of take it as like a small sign. I don't mean the baseball gods are like, hey, the Blue Jays are team of destiny now, but I do think that, you know, you can be on the wrong side of those and they feel really heavy, and then you could be on the right side of those and they end up really mattering. I don't know. It felt important for them to get a little good fortune on their side in addition to something like Vlad's big 3-run home run.
Yeah, they matter. Something felt very normal about that win. And I that's a strange thing to say, but the Blue Jays have not had a lot of wins that feel like they fit their identity, Blake, is probably a better way to say it. And their identity is a team that is very good defensively with good starting pitching. Okay, well, that's a start, but you can't win on those alone. You need a little bit of offense and probably enough offense to give you some cushion to deal with a bullpen that has not been very good. That's exactly how this game played out. Their strengths and weaknesses both showed up, and they still won, which is a really important thing. The Blue Jays have, I think, struggled to have much of an identity this year, and it's hard to form that when you're having tough losses, when you're losing games you're supposed to win. It hasn't made much sense this year along the way. Even when you look at their runs scored in the first and second inning, Blake, it doesn't make sense. So to have a win that lines up with their strengths and, frankly, their weaknesses in the bullpen, being able to weather those, that finally feels like a bit of a blueprint or a roadmap to go forward. Because if you are going to lean on pitching and defense, which it's one way to win ball games, I don't know if it's the best way, but it's one way, you got to hit. You got to get a few runs along the way, because too many times the Blue Jays, we've talked about this a million times, are putting their starters or relievers in a spot where if they screw up one time, the game is over. Yesterday, they were allowed to screw up a couple of times, and they still won. It's beautiful when you hit a home run.
It is. So let's talk about that. And look, Zach Pop and Jimmy Garcia have been very, very good for this team. You can afford them one shaky outing each happening in the same game, and the Jays still coming away with the victory is very, very nicely done. So there was the 3-run home run earlier in that game as well to create the initial lead. It was hit by Vladimir Guerrero Jr. It went the opposite way. It was his second home run of the series, and he just missed another one. So I know that Vlad's home run total on the season is not where people would like it to be. That was his 7th home run. We can go back to April 26th when his season kind of started shifting. He is 3rd in the majors in batting average since then, 2nd in the majors in on-base percentage since then. And yeah, he hasn't hit for a ton of power, but still 12th in OPS since then, with a 920 OPS during that stretch. If we look at the season-long numbers now, he is actually producing more than last year. His slugging percentage is a little lower, but the on-base percentage and batting average have taken such a big jump. And then when we adjust for the offensive environment of this year, where, you know, home runs are down about 20% relative to quality of contact and the league has an OPS under 700, his season so far offensively has actually been better than his 2022 season. Again, different style. He had 32 bombs that year. I think people would, given the way this team is made, I think people would actually probably trade in a little of Vlad's batting average and OBP for a little more power, but that's not on Vlad necessarily. What are you seeing here, and how close do you think he, like John Schneider talks all the time, and I know he talked to you guys about it yesterday, that they want Vlad to be a hitter first and the power will come. kind of seems like after a month of he's going to hit like 380, 390. Now we're starting to see it a little bit. Are you seeing it as well?
I think that Vladdy's a different type of hitter now. Like, he's a different genre of hitter. And for the last couple of years, I have viewed Vladdy as a worse version of his 2021 self, which in a lot of the time he was. Now I view him as a different type of hitter. He's kind of rebranded. Now, when he was coming up through the minor leagues, and certainly in 2021, he was more of that Manny Ramirez, Frank Thomas. Yeah, he was going to hit, but power was still the star of the show. Now, Blake, I view him more in the Joey Votto path, kind of high average, high on base. There will be some power. Now, of course, Vladdy is still an exit velocity monster with that, but you're not seeing him get under the ball like he did yesterday. That's the only difference. It's about if he's getting loft under the ball. So I see him more going in that Votto vein of hitter, which, again, these are all great names to be compared to, but a guy who's hitting for average, which has always been his great gift, reaching base because he does have a great eye when he's not overextending. Maybe the power isn't chasing 40 or 50. Maybe it's closer to 30. Yeah, you'd love more with this exact construction of team, but this seems to be working for Vladdy. And it's a difficult balance now of, do you allow yourself to want more, or do you say, Vladdy, this is great. Keep being exactly this hitter. Because in its own way, it's working. It's not working in the same way it did 4 years ago, but it's working. And Vladdy looks comfortable in all of this now. When he's bad, he's trying to do too much. We've heard Schneider say that 100 times over the years. Vladdy's trying to hit a 5-run home run. He's trying to be the hero. When Vladdy tries to be the hero, it's over. That's when he's OPSing 690. It's bad. Right now, he seems pretty in control and pretty comfortable with himself. It's just not the same self that we saw a few years ago. I think he has kind of rebranded, and I'm starting to at least try to view him through a different lens, because I think this is who he's actually trying to be. Not a worse version of who he used to be, but kind of a new type of hitter, if you will.
Yeah, and the Votto comp makes sense, right? Votto has had a tremendous career, only 330 home run seasons, and still a guy that a lot of pitchers fear, but he used that fear to get on base a ton, still produce a lot from an RBI perspective. Let's just hope Vlad doesn't step on a bat at any point, because then he'll go back to his home planet. We'll never hear from him again.
The most dangerous bat ever made, apparently.
Yeah, it had spikes coming out of it and stuff. Yeah, it's a tough one. So in terms of Vlad not trying to do too much, that is important to keep in mind. Would you like to see him try to do too much in a first inning at some point this weekend? Because the thing that you and I have been tracking for weeks now, the Jays have not scored a run in the first inning in 28 games. It is tied for the second longest streak in Major League Baseball history now. The record is 31. The Buffalo Bees, or Boston Bees, back in the 1920s or 1930s, we're almost there. If they don't score a run this weekend in the first inning, they will tie the major league record. Now, Oakland is, and this stat comes from Avery of Gate 14. They have the third most first inning runs allowed. I went and I dug these other ones up. They're also fourth. Teams are OPSing 850 against them in the first inning, and they're fourth last in starters ERA. Couldn't line up better unless you were facing the Chicago White Sox for six games on this streak. So not going to say it's a done deal, but how are we feeling about the streak?
My goodness, this has been so strange, because most of it doesn't make sense. They're the number one team scoring in the second inning. They've gotten some guys to third. So a big chunk of this is obviously weird luck and coincidence, of course, but it can't all be that. If I had to guess, if I was in a grade 7 science class trying to come up with a hypothesis for all of this, maybe this points to the direction of the Blue Jays' initial game plan not being as strong as their first glimpse reaction to a pitcher. Once they see a guy throw an inning, maybe they're reacting to that better than they're initially planning for it. Now, again, most of this is strange. I kind of have to preface that every time I annoy John Schneider with this question. But it's been amazing, and this team needs to get out in front of other teams. They're not built to chase. They're really not built to chase. This is the opposite of 2015 and 16. So a better way to frame early offense is probably innings 1-3 or first trip through the order offense. But this has become so strange. We're talking about MLB history if they do not score this weekend. There's been a lot of baseball played. You don't want to make that history. So So we'll see. Leadoff double today. We'll see if they bunt over or play really extreme for this, just so I stop asking about it. I'd be happy to inspire that, but this has been bizarre. This is the strangest thing of the season, and there's been a lot of strange.
And, like, I think the easiest way to capture that this is, like, random and weird and, like, they finally, partway through this streak, they finally did the thing everyone had been asking for, and they changed up the batting order. And since they did that, David Schneider and Danny Jansen have been below average hitters, and George Springer and Justin Turner, well, Justin Turner's scraped his way to average now over the last 3 weeks, and George Springer's been good. So they finally did the thing that everyone was calling for, and then the guys they swapped have kind of changed directions. I guess the one guy who has continued struggling, he had a brief bit in there, but it is cold again now, is Bo Bichette. It's weird. Like, it seems like everyone else at this point in the season, you know, Vlad has found it. George Springer's been a little better lately. Justin Turner started hot, had a nice series here. Like, everyone's had a stretch where they're going. And Bo Bichette, I don't know about you, I find him the toughest guy to evaluate because, like, even when he's going good, it doesn't necessarily pass the, like, oh, if we were drawing up what a guy's going to do in the lab. So it's a little hard to find ways to improve because, like, you don't want Bo Bichette to be super patient. You want him to be aggressive. You want a little chase in his profile because that's what makes him so dangerous when he's going. What have you made of Bo kind of, you know, there was that a couple games there where it looked like maybe it was clicking, but he's gone right back to kind of being cold here.
This is the most surprising thing of the season for me. I thought Bo Bichette would get MVP votes this year. I thought he'd be in the back end of that top 10 MVP voting. Like, I really thought this was going to be a year for Bo Bichette. And I have a lot of respect for him as a player because I see the amount of time he puts in. I see that tutelage of Marcus Semien very clearly every day. Bo is also his own biggest critic. John Schneider says that a lot, and that means something. This can get very difficult for a young player when they're used to having success and it's not coming around at this point. Because by this point, what is it, June 7th, it's got to come around by now. And like you said, Blake, he's so hard to evaluate because his swing and his approach is not like anybody else. And John Schneider said just yesterday, I think it was, that the blessing of what he is as a hitter is also a curse at times because he can get to any pitch. It can be a foot outside. He can get to it, but it's about focusing in on the zone. We haven't really seen Bo barreling up a lot of pitches over the heart of the plate lately. It's a lot of lunging out. You've seen a lot of lunging forward and extending his arms, which you don't have any power at that point. Shooting balls down the right field line. I know that's part of Bo's game. That's kind of his trademark hit, is shooting a ball past the first baseman. But you need some pull power in there as well. You need to be driving it up the middle. And it's been so surprising from Bo because he is the type of player who can change this entire lineup. He's the type of guy who can hit 330 for a couple of months with a bit of power, who can contribute on the bases as well. But we haven't seen that. And like I said, Bo is his own biggest critic. This can be tough for a young hitter, but it shocked me. I didn't see this one coming whatsoever. And I think it is still probably the biggest story in this offense because he's supposed to be, if not the best hitter, probably the second best. And he's one who has kind of stayed at this exact level all season, which has been really surprising.
Yeah. And there's not, you know, they've dropped him in the order, but he's hung around that middle part of the order and it just hasn't really come. And you look under the hood at some of the underlying stuff, you know, I can picture the swings you're talking about, right? Like two strike slider that's low and away, and it's just kind of a whiff at it where even if you can get to it, you're not doing damage with it. It's been a little perplexing. Okay. Let's say they score in the first inning this weekend. We have done you tied the franchise record for most consecutive games without scoring more than 5 runs. We did you broke the franchise record for longest drought, home run drought in the cleanup spot. And now you're threatening the major league record for a scoreless first inning streak. What's our next thing to get under John Schneider's skin about after this one? Is it Spencer Horwitz watch? That one's kind of already started.
It might be Spencer Horwitz watch. What have I been annoying about this year? The word damage I've been annoying about, certainly at points. These ones, I'm trying to think of what else the Blue Jays rank low at. They're probably not the highest stolen base team, but they do enough of that. I'm sure that I could annoy some people with some bunting talk. That always brings about a reaction, but it's got to be about something on the bases because these early scoring And the scoring five-run streak was another amazing one. This team just seems to get in ruts. Strange ones, but they seem to get stuck in them. Now, ideally, you'd take that same energy and get stuck in a winning streak if you're the Blue Jays, but we'll see. It's got to be something on the bases, though.
Yeah, I could see that. Let's not also mention that one of these wins to salvage the split was squeezing the ball at first base away from the game-winning run having been
picked off.
Let's not do that one. Okay, last thing on last night's games and this series in general. Yusei Kikuchi was so good that Brandon Hyde sounded after the game like John Schneider has sounded so many times this year, where it's just like, he didn't say tip your cap, but he was like, man, like, we know Kikuchi's got stuff. Yeah. And then he's throwing 97, 98. There had been a little bit of concern about Kikuchi over the last couple starts. You know, some of the metrics were down. Velocity was down. You know, he wasn't getting as much swing and miss. And then, man, yesterday was, if not the best version, something close to the best version we've seen of Yusei Kikuchi. Is that enough against that lineup, the number one lineup in baseball against left-handed pitching, that enough for you to kind of put a pin in the, hey, Kikuchi had a couple rough starts?
Yeah, that was his most important start of the season, I think. The context of that lineup, like you mentioned, is really intimidating. I don't care who you are. But Yusei kind of looked like his old self the last two times out, which I do not mean in a complimentary way. He looked like the lefty who would run into early turbulence and not exactly grind deep into a game. That was getting a bit worrying because this rotation cannot handle one more guy going down or struggling. It just can't right now. Kikuchi evolved a bit yesterday. He gave them some different looks. It was really impressive. And like you said, Blake, he was throwing 98. Which continues to blow my mind every time I walk by Yusei Kikuchi. I'm comfortably larger than the guy. He is, and you know, someone like Alek Manoah is comfortably larger than me. But it shows you what a pitcher can do with the torque of their body and with their lower body, which he uses so well. This is not a big guy with long arms getting extension. He is just someone who's maximizing his body and is in ridiculous shape, absolutely ridiculous. But to be able to get 98 out of his frame absolutely blows me away. It's amazing what he can do with the baseball. And I think the most important part of all this, again, Blake, is that the Jays can't afford a bad starter right now. They need their four veterans to be absolutely locked in because the number five spot's a bit shaky. You can handle that. You can't handle two shaky spots at this point. So you say save that, and he looked just fantastic.
And when we look ahead to this series, you know, you've got Chris Bassitt and Kevin Gausman in these first two games against respectively Hulk Hogan Harris and Luis Medina. And then that bullpen day on Sunday, potentially. I mean, we don't know exactly what they're going to do. You're probably thinking like, I mean, you're going in there thinking sweep. But if you're thinking take two, it's got to be the first two because you've got the question marks on Sunday. Do you quickly before I let you go here? You think we see Yariel Rodriguez by Sunday? He threw 43 pitches on Wednesday, so that would be one day short of a full five-day rotational rest, but he only threw 43 pitches.
Mm-hmm. And then he threw 15 more in the bullpen, so we can call it almost up to 60, okay, which would be getting close. Schneider said they wanted him around 75, which would be a natural jump from there. Maybe the opponent matters a little bit, not that you're not taking the A's seriously, but if you can roll out Francis and Richards one more time and try to do it better, it might be against them. The Blue Jays did take Rodriguez a bit slower last time, so maybe they do that this time, but he's much closer now than I thought he'd be. He was kind of hovering around a couple innings for a bit there, looks a lot better now, so maybe one more of Richards and Francis. Richards looked great, Francis did not, so we'll see how that goes. But Yariel, at the very most, just needs one more, which is very good news.
Yeah, it'll be Cleveland. Depending on how they handle the off day, it'll be Cleveland or Boston for the next bullpen day, which neither of those sound like particularly good spots. Keegan Mathieson, thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy. Have a great weekend.
You got it, Blake. Take care, man.
Keegan Mathieson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Make sure you're checking his workout. Subscribe to his newsletter. And yeah, as we always mention, keep an eye out for whenever the pre-sale notification comes up for the book he'll have out on the Blue Jays in 2025. All around good dude and one of our favorite guests. I mentioned earlier, we'll talk to Justin Choi of Fangraphs. We'll talk to Pat Malacaro, voice of the Buffalo Bisons. We'll talk to Melissa Lockhart about the state of the A's as their owner does owner nonsense and tries to hijack that team. Tonight is reverse boycott night. So if you're watching the Jays game at 9:40 on Sportsnet tonight, you will see a relative to what Oakland normally looks like, you'll see a pretty packed stadium. There is, in the Oakland Coliseum parking lot before the game, there's live music and you know, the last dive bar collective and community that some of the A's players have low-key gotten in trouble for supporting. All of that is going on tonight, so it should be a fun atmosphere around this game. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Justin Choi of FanGraphs about why fastball usage in the major leagues is down, but if you're a pitcher, you've probably never needed two different fastballs more. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays, get a split against the Orioles with a 6-5 victory last night. Vlad, big three-run homer. Adley Rutschman did his best to chip the Orioles back. A solo homer in the sixth, two-run homer in the eighth. Ryan O'Hearn pinch hit a two-run home run in the ninth against Jimmy Garcia, but the Jays hung on. They win 6-5. They salvage a split against the Orioles. They're back within two games of 500 with a chance to get north of that against the Oakland Athletics this weekend. Mentioned, and we'll continue to talk about throughout the show, it is a reverse boycott night down in Oakland tonight. So should be a fun energy around that game. And yeah, hopefully the Jays can string together a third win in a row as Chris Bassitt takes on Hogan Harris. Chris Bassitt is always a fascinating pitcher. I got a chance to talk to him about some kind of pitch design and stuff earlier this week for a piece that I'm working on. He's a guy that throws eight pitches. We call that a kitchen sink guy, you know? And Baseball Prospectus has recently written about why there are more kitchen sink guys in the majors now. And by that, I mean guys who will throw four or five different pitches and throw them all a decent amount of time. By the way, Hogan Harris is another guy like that on the other side of this matchup tonight. Justin Choi made his return to FanGraphs writing about this and you know, why it's never been more important to have multiple fastball options if you're a pitcher. Justin joins us now. What's going on, man? Welcome back to the baseball writing scene. Your first piece back at FanGraphs in a while.
Hey, Blake. It's good to finally be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for doing it. What brought you back to the game, man? It's nice to see your work back.
I'm not back as a in a full time role or anything. It's a freelance piece, but I am writing about baseball again on like a semi regular basis. So yeah, it's gonna spend some time in researching, writing, doing the stuff I like.
Well, it's great to see, man. I really like your work. The piece at FanGraphs was called One Fastball Isn't Enough. And you kind of dove into, you know, hey, fastball usage is down in Major League Baseball. It's something that we've talked about a lot, but it's never really been more important to not only have a fastball, but have a sinker or a cutter to pair with it and play off of it. We'll get into some of the specifics, but give us the high level of why that is the case. Why is it so important right now to have multiple fastball options?
Yeah, so basically the simple idea is that it's not enough today in today's game to have just a strikeout pitch. You also have to consider the platoon advantages that you can or maybe can't get depending on what types of pitches you have. So the great thing about having a lot of fastball options is that, you know, since sinkers are very good against same-handed matchups, but they're very weak against opposite-handed matchups, you know, if you're able to complement that with a cutter or a four-seam fastball, which are more platoon neutral, then you can, you know, effectively generate weak contact and just have, you know, like a better time overall as a pitcher.
So a lot of your piece and your research focused on that weak contact. So you would kind of in how you laid out the methodology, you kind of put aside, okay, let's leave walks and strikeouts and hit by a pitch aside just for a second here. Let's focus on how you generate weak contact. Obviously, you know, if we're looking at strikeouts and things like that, we're going to start talking a lot more about the slider, you know, the breaking stuff that gets more swing and miss. But in terms of inducing weak contact, you had an interesting point in there that for lower velocity guys, especially, the sinker can sometimes grade out as just a better pitch generally than your four-seam fastball. I think you said that, you know, by stuff plus up to 97 miles an hour, the sinker might just be a better option than a lesser fastball. Is that, you know, is that something we should kind of keep in mind is for these lower velocity guys, like, hey, you might want to, like, Jose Berríos, for example, has used his sinker a lot more this year instead of the straight four seam fastball, and he's like a 94, 95 guy. Do you think we'll see even more guys who are below that kind of 96 threshold lean on the sinker more than the straight four seam?
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to generalize because the results were based on driveline stuff plus model, and they have their own methodology that I don't have access to. So I don't know exactly how they, you know, went around building their model, but I do think that they have a point. What's really interesting is that, you know, I think that if you don't have standout velocity, your four-seam fastball is going to look pretty regular in today's game, you know, because like, you know, even college kids these days, they see like, you know, 95, 96, 97 miles per hour. They're used to the straight shapes that a four-seam fastball might have. So I think that there is a pretty good chance that we're going to see a lot more two fastball, three fastball guys, especially guys who, you know, don't have like this plus-plus four-seam fastball. And they compensate for that by adding more variety to their arsenal.
So we've seen teams like the Blue Jays, again, who don't have, you know, Kikuchi throws really, really hard. The rest of their starters don't have that super high-end velocity. Berríos has leaned on the sinker more. Bassett's always used it as his first pitch. Kevin Gausman added one back this year to his arsenal. And then we see teams like, hey, the Dodgers have been teaching a lot of their guys sinkers. The Red Sox, who I know they haven't had the best couple of years here, but generally they've been a really like pitching information forward organization. And they're kind of the leaders in stop throwing the four seam, throw more of the sinkers and cutters. When you look at the fact that, and Dodgers are always, are obviously front of mind, not just because you're a Dodgers guy, but because they're such a smart organization, is that, that's a pretty good bellwether for you that, hey, the really smart pitching teams are doing this. It's a good sign that we're onto something here when we look at it.
Yeah. So funnily enough, the Dodgers are actually sort of at the bottom in terms of sinker and cutter usage. And I think that, you know, they might not believe in what I believe necessarily, but it could also be because, you know, like pitch usage at any given year or any given team depends really on like what pitchers you have on that team. You know, it could be a coincidence this year that, you know, like this team happens to have a lot of pitchers who have a good four seamer and they throw it a lot. But it is, I think, interesting to see that the teams that throw the most sinkers and cutters this year have been, I think it was the Red Sox, Brewers, the Rays, and also I think the Giants. And these are all clubs that pay a lot of attention to pitching development. And they have this philosophy where, you know, it's not just they have like a one size fits all approach. They really try to understand what makes a pitcher tick. And I think that having more of a fastball variety is kind of like, it helps you adapt to what pitchers' different strengths are and what their weaknesses are too.
Yeah, it makes sense. And yeah, even if the Dodgers aren't the, you know, tippy top, we've seen Glasnow toy with one, and obviously he's got the four seamer up. And that's kind of part of the take, you know. I know you went into pitch sequencing. We didn't get as finite necessarily as location as well, but yeah, the four seam up and then this other stuff to play lower in the zone, you know, whether it's the splitter off of it or the two seamer and things like that. So there is a lot of what you wrote about has to do with sequencing as well. And you know, you basically built these decision tree models that would look at weak contact as an outcome and kind of work backwards of like, okay, what would set that up? And when you went through that, it's, yeah, the sinker and cutter are important, but they're particularly important to start counts. Can you walk us through that takeaway a little bit?
Right. So I guess the main thing to understand is that, so what I'm measuring here is run value, and it's run value adjusted for count, especially, you know, the fact that if you have a two-strike count and you induce a batted ball, that's actually not that good because you've already found yourself in a state where it's very likely that batters are going to strike out. And if you go from that outcome and you actually, if you get a ground ball, then, you know, on average, that's going to be worse than just getting a clean strikeout, right? Whereas if you fall in behind the count, let's say it's like 2-0 and you manage to get a ground ball, that's a pretty great outcome relatively because, you know, you were once stuck in this hole and now you've escaped it by getting a weak grounder. And so this shows up in the fact that the model doesn't really like when pitchers try to use pitch to contact pitch types in two strike counts, like sinkers and to an extent cutters, because they think that it's you're losing a lot of opportunity here. You could be throwing a like a wipeout slider instead, but it thinks highly of you if you try to attack the zone with sinkers and cutters when you're behind, because it gives you an opportunity to escape the situation. So I think that sort of like nuanced approach to pitching based on not only like the matchup, but also the count that you're in, I think the model is factoring that in, and it's drawing some pretty important conclusions. And I think that, you know, a lot of teams, they probably do pay attention to this already, but, you know, there's always room for optimization. I think that we're going to see a lot of more teams and pitchers, you know, try to really take into specific situations into account and adapt as they go in terms of using pitches.
Toward the end of your piece, you linked to something Timothy Jackson wrote last week at Baseball Prospectus called The Return of the Kitchen Sink. And, you know, lead aside about his actual sink, this is more about why guys are throwing, you know, why there are more guys throwing 4+ pitches and working all of those in, you know, 10% of the time and more. And again, this is tangentially Jays related because Bassett is a guy like that. You know, Berríos is a guy like that. Kevin Gausman's tried to add a fourth pitch and so on. Bowden Francis has added a fourth pitch and so on down the line. Obviously, if you have high end stuff, you can get away with just two pitches. But we're even seeing some relievers, like Jimmy Garcia for the Jays is having the best season of his career, and he's a kitchen sink reliever, which is pretty unusual. Do you think this is where, like, is this a moment in time thing, or is this kind of where we're trending, unless you're one of those guys that has, like, tippy-top stuff?
So first of all, I love Jimmy Garcia. I think he's, like, the ideal pitcher in this day and age. I mean, this is a guy who went from being just pretty much a fastball slider guy into someone who throws like a sweeper and a slider and also a splitter and also a four seam and a sinker. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I think that, you know, the fact that Garcia was able to make this transformation, it shows that, you know, like it doesn't have to be limited to just pitchers who have like, say, subpar stuff or velocity. I mean, you know, if you have the ability to develop multiple pitches, then you should go for it. Absolutely. You should, you know, try to consider like, okay, like if I have this sort of weakness or if I have this sort of opportunity that I can take, you know, like how should I go about implementing it and what pitch types are most appropriate for my arm slot and, you know, just how my body works and like what I'm able to throw. And I think that, you know, like adopting this sort of like flexible mindset will help a lot of pitchers down the road and not just like, you know, not just the stereotypical like kitchen sink pitchers, but also like these high end relievers too. You know, it can make them even better if they just add, you know, like a sinker or a cutter or even like a splitter. I think that can be a big difference.
There was one other note in your piece I wanted to ask you about, and it's, you know, I know it's been studied and it's out there, but I hadn't really thought about it a ton. And it was the note that pitchers have more control over launch angle than exit velocity. And sometimes, you know, we think of a pitcher getting hit hard and assume that was kind of, you know, oh, they made a mistake or their stuff isn't there. You know, Kevin Gausman gave up like one of the highest hard hit rates in the Statcast era the other day and said after the game, I thought I had really good stuff. The Orioles just like hit it well. Was that surprising to you when we kind of discovered that pitchers have more control over the launch angle than how hard a pitch gets hit?
It was definitely surprising. I remember first coming up on that result and I was initially skeptical because, you know, I was like, I mean, we do see pitchers and there are pitchers who do get hard on a regular basis. And it seems like, you know, it shouldn't be the case that pitchers can only, well, not only, but, you know, it can't be the case that pitchers can't control exit velocity. But I think the thing that made it click for me is that exit velocity is also a product of launch angle, right? So a lot of the hardest hit balls tend to be in like the 20 to 30 degree range. And it's really hard to hit a ball at like 60 degrees or like negative 50 degrees, right? And those extreme angles are actually the angles that pitchers have more control over. So, you know, in fact, by controlling launch angle, you're also controlling exit velocity. It's just that if you look at the exit velocity data alone, it may not look like pitchers are really doing anything to influence that, and which is true in a way because there's no direct correlation, but there is an indirect correlation in the sense that if you control launch angle, you can also control exit velocity.
Right, that makes sense.
The key point.
Okay, Justin, before I let you go here, I know you're a big KBO guy as well, the Korean League. We've seen a couple guys come back this year, Eric Fetty, Albert Suarez, come back from Korea, have some success. I don't want to put you too much on the spot this early in the season, but anyone who should be on our radar in terms of, hey, we're looking at guys who might come back over next year, and this can be Korean players as well who might just hit free agency. There's also Blue Jays legend Socrates Brito, I saw, is having a pretty good season over there. Anyone in the KBO should be on our radar right now?
Sure. So there's this young outfielder for the KT Wiz. His name is Baek Ho Kang. So his last name is Kang, K-A-N-G. Plays for the KT Wiz, and he didn't receive a lot of spotlight in recent years because he had a bit of a slump, and he also suffered from a hamstring injury, and so his performance kind of dipped for a while, but now he's just fully back. He's hitting like a monsoon. He's tearing up the league, and I like to think of him as, you know, like if you have Jungwoo Lee, you take Jungwoo Lee, you take out the defense, but you add in more power. I think that's the sort of player that he is. And so he might not have a lot of defensive value in the future, but he can really hit. He hits for average. He hits for power. He also has a decent arm. And so I think that once he gets posted in a few years, he's going to receive a lot of attention from major league clubs. As long as he keeps us his current pace, that's not a guarantee, of course, but I think he's talented enough to the point where, you know, like, I can trust him, you can trust him, we can trust him to do great things and hopefully one day play for a major league team.
Nice. Yeah, and still only 24. You mentioned, I just looked at the stats, 17 home runs in 61 games. He's hitting .324. Pretty good, yeah, for a 24-year-old coming off a couple seasons partially lost to injury. Justin, last one for you. I lied. That wasn't the last one. You're a Dodgers fan. How has the experience this year been so far? I imagine it's been pretty fun. Huge series this weekend with the Yankees too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing since the offseason, pretty much, ever since Ohtani came on. I remember eating at a restaurant and then I got a notification on my phone from Jeff Passan, and yeah, Ohtani was a Dodger. And like from that point on, you know, I couldn't believe it for an entire month, but I think, you know, like once I saw Ohtani hitting dingers in the spring training, it kind of, you know, like wow, this is real. And, you know, it's been phenomenal to see the trio of Mookie and Freddie and Ohtani at the top, and also Will Smith. He's, I think he's the best catcher in baseball. Of course, I'm biased though. So yeah, it's been really fun to watch the Dodgers, and I'm looking forward to the Yankee series, of course. And yeah, I mean, like the Dodgers don't have much interaction with the Blue Jays, unfortunately. But, you know, I think there's like this common, this is common theme where like there are a lot of Koreans who flock to the Dodgers and the Blue Jays. And so like I have a couple of Blue Jays friends and we talk about the team. And so like, it's nice to have a connection with the Blue Jays as well. And yeah, like I'm rooting for the Blue Jays too, you know?
Thank you. I appreciate it. And yeah, the Dodgers were here a little earlier in the year. It did not go well for those in the fan base who booed Shohei Ohtani in his first plate appearance here. But yeah, I'm glad you're having fun with it. They've been a blast to watch. That series is obviously huge this weekend. Justin, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Really glad to see you doing some more baseball work again.
Yeah, I appreciate it so much. It was nice talking. Thank you so much.
Justin Choi of Fangraphs. The piece is called One Fastball Isn't Enough. You can go over to Fangraphs and read a little bit more if you're curious about the methodology and to go a little deeper on why so many guys now, hey, yeah, the four seam, even if it's a good four seam, even if I can locate it high in the zone, I got to have a cut or two or a sinker or something like that. Now, we can get super pedantic. You know, if Chris Black were on with us today, he'd probably be like, actually, a cutter's closer to a breaking ball than a four seam fastball, which is probably true. But you know, it's a cut fastball. We call it what we call it. So interesting trend there around Major League Baseball as pitchers try to figure out the right mix to generate weak contact at a time when, for the first time in forever, strikeout rates have kind of plateaued. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Pat Malacaro, voice of the AAA Buffalo Bisons, when we return.
big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Hope you're having a good Friday. The Blue Jays on their way to Oakland to open up a three set there. They obviously split with the Orioles yesterday. And then if you were using the afternoon start to take in some AAA action in your evening, you would have seen the Buffalo Bisons make a big comeback late, tie it in the ninth, send it to extras, ultimately come up short against Lehigh Valley. Let's go down to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Let's talk to the voice of those Buffalo Bisons, Pat Malacaro. Pat, how we doing, buddy?
Blake, great to chat with you today. Excited to chat with you after what was a tough loss last night for the team, but the regulars were in on the action as usual for the offense. The pitching wise, it was a strong performance. Just couldn't pull it out in extra innings.
Yeah, this is the this is pretty natural with the Bisons. Even when you guys aren't winning, the stat lines are there. The box score looks good, and 30-30. It's not like it's been. It's just been a bit of a rough week for you guys after that that big win on Saturday. Before we talk about the team, I want to talk about you for a little bit. For Jays fans who aren't as familiar, so you've been the voice of the Buffalo Bisons since 2018, but you have also been a part of that organization since 1999, back when they were the Herd, as a bat boy. Man, what has that path been like? Can you run us through kind of the, I guess, what, 25 years now with the Bisons / Herd organization? How'd you get involved as a bat boy in the first place?
Yeah, and it goes back to even as a child. I'm a lifelong Buffalo resident, so I've grown up in the old bleacher seats when there were 22,000 people a night, over a million fans a season. So I've been a Bison fan my whole life, and actually had a family relative who worked in the front office, and I thought it'd be pretty cool to work in baseball, and thinking just maybe I'd be an usher, a ticket taker, or something like that. And sure enough, when I became a freshman in high school, there was an opportunity. And for 4 years, I worked in the clubhouse and kind of said, yeah, broadcasting's pretty fun. It looks like what these guys do day in and day out is a pretty fun job. So that's something I really wanted to do from joining the team in 99, and have worked my way up, and just have been very fortunate to work with some great people over the years too. My broadcast partner, Duke McGuire, who's been a baseball lifer for over 50 years, somebody I enjoy working with day in and day out, from him to the clubhouse staff to the front office. It's been a really fun experience, and I was happy to take over in 2018 to get this full-time role.
Yeah, and look, the Blue Jays organization on the radio broadcast side is flush with Syracuse grads too, for whatever reason. You and Ben Shulman doing that. Okay, last one on you before we talk about the team. So I remember seeing a clip of you at some point interviewing Eric Bischoff, who used to run WCW and then went to WWE at a Bisons game. He's in a Bisons jersey and everything. What is like the coolest or strangest interview you've got to do covering Bisons games?
I think that might be it, because it was part of a wrestling night at the ballpark, and my role was kind of the dugout reporter. And, you know, over the course of only the home game, 71 games, you've got to try and keep it fresh. So interviewing the manager every single night, you know, can get a little tedious and monotonous. So we thought, what the heck, let's set up outside the broadcast booth, talk to Eric Bischoff. The unique part of it was the addendum to the story was Gwinnett was in town. So Tony Schiavone, who's now with the AEW promotion, was in the ballpark, and it was the first time that those two had been in relatively the same area since WCW ended. So that was a kind of a surreal moment for someone who grew up following the whole thing. And it was fun. But you know, talking to Eric, it was one of those where as a wrestling promoter, he appreciated minor league baseball, because every night's it's own unique entity, and that's something he really kind of was drawn to as well. So it was a funny part of the story.
Yeah, and it's a good point, right? Like, obviously, the games are the games, but you also have to find fresh ways to keep fans in the seats. And for anyone who doesn't know, actually, I should ask if you guys are still doing this, but I know for the first little bit of the season, the Buffalo Bisons were accepting Canadian money at par, for example, to get the Canadian fans down. You guys have the $2 hot dog Tuesdays and stuff like that, all sorts of good stuff coming up throughout the summer. Okay, so let's talk about this team. Bit of a losing streak this week, but 30-30, pretty good overall. Where is this team at? You know, this week aside, feel pretty good about where they're at and where they're going, especially on the offensive side of the ball, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and some of the young prospects, unfortunately, Leo Jimenez is out with an injury right now, and he's on the injured list. But we were seeing signs that Leo was not only adding the defensive side of the game at shortstop, he was basically the everyday shortstop for Buffalo. Aurelvis Martinez was getting the start at second. So that's quite the combination up the middle. And Aurelvis hit his 14th home run of the season last night. An absolute no doubt, 102 off the bat. I mean, everything is off his bat, off Addison Barger's bats. They're just hard contact. So it's exactly what you're looking for if you're the Blue Jays organization. You know, in terms of Aurelvis offensively at the plate, maybe he's gone back to a little bit of the struggles that you saw in Double A before his promotion last year, because I thought when he came up to Triple A, his ability to adapt to the strike zone, working with Matt Haig and using the full ABS, the full automatic ball strike system that if people aren't familiar with, 3 days of the week, Hawkeye technology, which you may see on the Sportsnet broadcasts for a game telling you where the ball actually crossed the strike zone. That's used 3 days of the week. So the umpire doesn't call the balls and strikes. It's a finite strike zone. And Aurelvis did a good job last year of using that to his advantage. And a lot of the Bison hitters did. I think maybe the last month or so for Aurelvis, you know, as the home runs have come, there have been some more bigger swings of stuff outside of the zone. So he started to cut down on that a little bit. And then, you know, Addison Barger, between the defense and the offense, you know, he's right back to where you would have expected going into 2023. And don't forget, he dealt with that elbow issue last year for almost 2 months. And I think that really hampered his season. The power numbers weren't there to start the year after a very strong 2022. As 2023 went on, you saw more power coming along. And you know, with the added size that he added in the offseason, I think you're seeing a lot of that come to light here in 2024.
I do want to ask more about Barger, but back to Aurelvis Martinez for just 1 second. So that's a good indication of, you know, early in the year, there were a lot of questions. Why isn't he coming up? Why not call this guy up? And it was like, well, let's hold up. Like the power is very, very real, but there's still some, like, he's 22. There's still some approach stuff he's working on. He's also still working on the defensive side. And I know that he had late last year moved to second base. We thought maybe it'd be a full-time move. He's now getting some reps in at third base. Where is his defense right now at either of those positions?
I think it's definitely getting better, and his ability to turn double plays is something that's very noticeable. I mean, obviously, as a shortstop, you're turning them anyway, but you know, a little bit of a different angle from second base now, and getting that, the ability to, you know, with his arm angle, the way he throws, making sure that the throw is accurate and on time. And that was maybe the biggest issue for him transitioning to second base is with his arm side positioning, making sure that he was getting the throws down. You'd see it sail a little bit on him. And, you know, whether it be Spencer Horwitz, we saw Damiano Parmigiani, Raleigh Tirado right now at first base, you know, pulling a lot of those in and sometimes result in errors. But I think really the defensive side of his game has come along nicely. He's played a lot more third base as Spencer Horwitz has played second over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, that's a little bit of a difference in the defense. And again, injuries have played such a big part of it as well. Without Parmigiani in the lineup, without Leo Jimenez, Casey Candel and the coaching staff with the front office of the Blue Jays have had to get a little bit creative in terms of, all right, maybe we wanted to see somebody at second base or shortstop more, but we have more of a need to put them in back into a different role. And we've kind of maybe seen that over the last couple of weeks as a reason why maybe the inconsistency of the wins and losses has kind of been there.
Yeah, and I thought I had seen the last of Addison Barger at shortstop, but he's back there playing every so often. And that's obviously a big dude to be playing shortstop, but he had that incredible double play the other night where from shortstop, he tracks all the way into shallow right center to make a tough catch and then guns the runner out at home trying to tag up. So there's obviously some skill there. I don't think, you know, I don't think Barger's major league position is going to be shortstop. But when you see a guy like that who, I mean, the power off the bat, the exit velocities and things like that speak for themselves. But a guy who, with that skill set, has been able to play a little bit of shortstop, a good third base, learn both corner outfield spots on the fly, play even a little bit of first base. What does that tell you about, you know, his, I mean, obviously it opens up multiple paths to the majors. There are a couple different positions he could fill in at, but that ability to pick all of those things up, to do that many different things, about his kind of capacity to keep improving, what does that tell you?
I think he's just a pure athlete. And I think that's something that can't be necessarily, taken undervalued for this organization. And yeah, when you look at, why he was called up in Kansas City and played left field, it's because he's a natural athlete. And last year, I go back to, he had never really played right field. The Bisons were in Syracuse. And in maybe his first or second game, he had to go back to the wall, brought a home run back over the wall from right field, and he just has good natural instincts. You see the play right there where he just spins and throws, bounces it one hop to the plate. The accuracy of the arm, he can basically put his back up against the wall at the line in right field and throw on the fly. And that's something that very few players I've ever seen be able to do from right field. So the arm is there, the athleticism, the instinct, I think, is something that also you can't teach. And he has very good instincts in the outfield, which has allowed him to pick up those positions quite well. And yeah, you know, he's added left field this year. And, you know, the first time he played first base for Buffalo, it was out of necessity because Palmigiani was injured in the first game of a doubleheader. The Bisons were in a stretch of games where they just didn't really have anybody else to play the position. He raised his hand and said, put me there. I want to play the position. So, you know, that's another part of this story, that Addison Barger is willing to try different positions. He knows as a natural athlete, I think, that if that versatility is there, the bat's going to carry him as well as the defense at multiple different positions.
Okay, so that's two of the kind of big three prospects. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here. Spencer Horwitz came out of a close game in a pinch hit situation last night. Anything we should know there?
I don't know anything at this point. Yeah, it's one of those where, yeah, he had, I think, three at-bats, another typical Spencer Horwitz night, an extra base hit, which leads the league in extra base hits, had a walk. He's, you know, .450 on base, is the best in the International League in almost 40 years last year, and he's improved on that. So, yeah, it raised a few eyebrows for sure last night. But, yeah, I didn't find out anything post-game other than that Will Robertson, another lefty, took his place.
Okay. So, yeah, definitely it's not a platoon advantage thing. Obviously, Horwitz is too good. You wouldn't make that swap anyway. We'll just say it's interesting for today. Okay, let's round out the position player side. And I could ask you about Horwitz. We've done a ton on Horwitz on the show, and you helped us get him on the show last week. Thank you for that, by the way. Then there's the outfield group here, and this is a deep outfield group. So Nathan Lucas, who Jays fans know a little bit from last year, you know, not exactly prospect age anymore, but having another great season, good defensively, very well-rounded. And he leads an outfield that also has Stuart Baroa, who's probably raised his stock more than anyone, I would think, with Buffalo this year. Will Robertson, who had such a great close the last year in Arizona Fall League. Cam Eden, who we saw briefly. Rafael Antigua, who had a breakout. Can you remember an outfield core this deep for the Bisons?
No, honestly, I can't. And that includes guys like Kevin Pillar, who rocketed through the organization and made such an impact in the big leagues, as we all know. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought up Nathan Lucas, because I think he's just a guy that goes about the game and he shows his teammates playing the game the right way, whether it's taking his approach at the plate. He's not the biggest guy in the world, but he knows his strengths. And somebody that came from, whether it be drafted by Cleveland, came through the Tampa Bay Rays organization. We saw him a little bit in 2019. I feel like he's that typical player coming out of the Rays mold where he just does everything well. Maybe he doesn't overwhelm you with his abilities, but the way he just does everything well is something that's so valuable. A left-handed batter is something that it makes him even more valuable, hitting .333 this year, team MVP in Buffalo in 2022. I know everyone was very excited that he broke camp at last year with the Blue Jays and got considerable big league time. I think for him, just getting the opportunity. You talk about somebody that has a good arm. He has a sneaky good arm. It's very accurate. Again, maybe because of his size, he's not as big as someone like Will Robertson, or even I think Cam Eden plays bigger than his size because of his instincts and abilities in the field. And it seems like he's a lot taller than 6'1 or 6'2 than he is. But I feel like Lucas does all those things well. And a lot of players have picked up a lot of those habits from him also. And he's not that old either, but he's a veteran who's been around this game long enough. And you know, the element of speed. Stuart Baroa, the league leader in stolen bases. Cam Eden set the Bison single season record last year with 53. And I think both he and Baroa are going to easily shatter that if they're both here for almost all, if not the entire season this year. So, yeah, this is a team that does it a lot of different ways. And everybody brings something different to the table, I think, which is also an added element to this team.
So, you know, the fact that this team is 30-30 and we just talked about like eight different guys who are having great seasons offensively suggests, you know, maybe the pitching side's been a little bit tougher, and obviously the Jays have had to dip down into that Buffalo pitching staff a handful of times here. But let's talk about a positive. Yariel, you got to see Yariel Rodriguez's last rehab start. I know he threw 43 pitches, did a little in the bullpen after as well. We don't know if that'll be the last one for him, and he's coming up to join the Jays on Sunday, or if he's going to do one more. But how good did he look in that last outing?
As good as we've seen him. And here's somebody who, you know, we thought was going to have to build up for at least a month or so, maybe, coming into the season, having not really pitched at all professionally last year. And he joined the team in Worcester and had two really good starts. And that's the same guy that we saw really over his four outings now with the Bisons. You mentioned came out of the bullpen last time and just three dominant innings with four strikeouts. The stuff is there. It's just a matter of, you know, having not pitched, I think, last year, making sure that when an injury creeps up, that it doesn't linger, and that, you know, whether it's four outings, five outings, you know, beyond that, whatever, that it's not something that continues to creep up this year. So I think Briario Rodriguez, much like Bowden Francis, when he was here with Buffalo and then rejoined the Blue Jays this week, it was just making sure that you got the innings in, that there were no lingering effects from either injury. And I think for Rodriguez, if that was his last appearance with the team, before going back to Toronto, he did everything you would have expected and hoped if you're the Blue Jays.
Okay. Eric Swanson is another guy who's down there. That's a different scenario. He was optioned down there. It's not an injury, although he was with you guys earlier in the year on a rehab as well. I know he didn't have the best outing last time, but how has he been over the three appearances he's made? And I guess, I don't know, a guy who has had that much major league success and that much major league experience, give a bit of a shot of the arm to the bullpen down there to have another guy like that in there?
Oh, I think it does, definitely. And again, it's another case of somebody who you can bounce ideas off of. This is still a very young bullpen. You look at guys like Connor Cook, who came to Buffalo at the end of last season. And I know he has a wipeout slider, maybe a little bit of a different arsenal than Eric Swanson does. But, you know, there's a lot you can learn from guys like Eric Swanson and your ability to go out and throw 70 times in a season when you maybe hadn't done it before. And to that level, how do you prepare in between appearances? What's your routine like? How many times a week do you throw? All those different things that play into, look, guys may have, you know, a game 70 times, but they make it up a couple additional times and get loose and ready to go. So how do you as a player kind of respond to that? And that's another thing. This pitching staff is very young. It's something we've seen now really across minor league baseball. Guys drafted within the last 2 to 3 years. Look at Hayden Yeager, who is now a veteran of this bullpen, who is throwing about as well, I think, as he has since coming up in 2022, was drafted almost a little bit over a year before he made his AAA debut. So I think there's a lot guys can learn from veterans. And that's one thing the Blue Jays have done as well, is gone out as the season started, whether it was Bo Sulzer, who came out of the bullpen or started last night, but went to the bullpen. Aaron Sanchez will start for the team tonight. You know, we all know his story in the Blue Jays organization. Toronto has gone out and signed a lot of veterans to help supplement this Bison's pitching staff so that the young players can develop and that they can learn from them as well.
Which is a great way to do it. And you mentioned Hayden Yeager there, that you know, that's quick through the minors, like you said. In terms of who, and I don't want to put you on the spot too much because Swanson's down there and they just sent Ryan Burr. But if there's a name we haven't seen in the majors yet who you think, you know, has looked good enough and might be next up, is Hagen Danner maybe that guy? I know he's had a really good season down there.
Yeah, I think so. And yesterday, first time in six games or seven games now that he had given up runs. So I think he is ready to go back to the big leagues. His stuff is there. You mentioned, you know, Connor Cook as well. Somebody has a wipeout slider. Danner's stuff is a little bit different. And, you know, story's unique in being a former catcher converted to pitcher. 97 with the fastball consistently with a good breaking ball as well. I think, yeah, if you're looking for options, if you're needed here in Buffalo, Hagen Danner is probably at the top of the list. And then, you know, go to somebody like Cook as well, who has really been steady out of the bullpen. And, you know, those are two guys that have locked things down in the eighth or ninth inning. They've been able to be the guys relied upon to go out there and pick up saves and get big outs when they've needed them.
I have almost no recollection of Hagen Danner's one third of an inning with the major league team last year in August, off my radar a little bit. Last one before I let you go here, Pat. There was that scary moment on Friday with Peyton Henry. You guys have been providing us with a lot of updates. Peyton Henry himself took to Twitter to thank everyone kind of for the thoughts and prayers and things like that. I know he's in concussion protocol, but have you guys gotten to talk to him? Has the team got to talk to him or FaceTime or anything like that? How is Peyton doing?
Yeah, and actually, fortunately enough, he was able to see the team in Syracuse on Saturday after he was released from the hospital. So that was it was such a welcome sight. There were messages going back and forth after he was at the hospital that Friday night and was able to see the team on Saturday. And I think for everyone, just, you know, obviously you never want to see a situation like that happen, but to see Peyton come into the clubhouse the next day to greet everyone kind of eased a lot of people's nerves and fears as well. So that was a welcome sight, and hopefully he'll be back with the team very soon.
Hope so. Sending him our best thoughts. Pat, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Enjoy the rest of this series. Man, these six-game series, I don't know, what's that like, life on the road for six games at a time in Lehigh Valley?
I'll tell you what, it's honestly nicer in respect of the old setup where you might be in two or three cities over the course of 5 days. So you just kind of save some of the stories that you might have told in a quick two-game series. You spread them out over 6 days so that you don't recycle the same material a couple of times.
Makes sense. Well, you're doing a great job of it, man. Appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Thanks, Blake.
Pat Malcaro, voice of the Buffalo Bisons on the play-by-play side, also a Sabres reporter for WGR. I do something a little different here. I don't play a lot of clips on the show. A lot of the time, I think it's just easier to just paraphrase what someone said rather than set up a whole clip and make Amit pull it and clip it and have Jennifer play it. But our pal Lindsay Dunn sat down recently with Lisa Loeb. So Lisa Loeb, if you don't know, is the woman who sings the song Stay, which is a terrific song from like the late 90s. And it has that you say part that plays whenever you say Kikuchi strikes someone out. 2 years ago on this show, I played it once on the show, and then technical producer Derek Brandale would play it as a drop when we were talking about Yusei Kikuchi. It's turned into a thing that the Blue Jays use now. Yusei Kikuchi told Lindsay Dunn how much he loves it. Lisa Loeb then tweeted about it, and Lisa Loeb sat down with our friend Lindsay Dunn of City News TO to talk about how cool it is for her that Kikuchi uses this. Here's a clip from that interview that, again, you can check out on City News TO in full.
I'm curious, just how did you find out about Yusei Kikuchi after he strikes somebody out that they play your song?
It was really funny. Actually, my son has somebody he works with, like, for school. And he came to me and he said, I don't know if you know this, but I saw this piece on YouTube about a pitcher. And every time he's on the field, you know, he strikes someone out, they play your song. And I thought, wow, I didn't know that this teacher knew my music very well. Apparently he does. And second of all, I was like, oh, that's so cool. And I went and looked it up and I saw a story that you had done on him. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And I thought, that's so neat that, that a Japanese baseball player likes my music. That's so cool, because I am a big fan of going to Japan. I have an amazing Japanese fan base. I was just there for spring break. And then as we were tweeting about it on one of the social medias, you know, I realized, oh, duh. You say that it's his name sounds like you say. Very clever and cute. But then I also saw he was a fan on your piece. So I was excited about both the puzzle of it, the sonic, you know, the sonic similarities, but also that he was a fan. You say Kikuchi. Otsukare sama deshita. Arigatou gozaimasu. Thank you so much, you say.
Ah, that's really great. Lindsay Dunn did a great job interviewing Lisa Loeb there. You can check out the whole thing over at City News TO. Cute little thing. And then, it's helpful. I don't know that I would have played that today if Yusei Kikuchi didn't have such a nails start yesterday. But he did. He was awesome. His velocity was up around like 98 at times. This was, of course, coming off of a couple starts where the stuff hadn't necessarily looked as good in terms of swing and miss and just raw velocity. He got 21 swings and miss yesterday. That is real good. Averaged 96 on the fastball, touched 98. He looked very, very comfortable and very, very much back to Yusei Kikuchi. We'll see him next against a Brewers team that can hit a little bit as well. Cade Povich on the other side of that last night. I know we teed it up briefly and we hadn't seen him in the major leagues. I was a little unimpressed. I know he gave them length after struggling a little bit. And I know he throws five pitches and from the left side. And obviously there's a real upside there in time. But for someone who, and yesterday wasn't the only time he's dealt with walk issues. He's dealt with walk issues in the minors as well. The fastball wasn't all that, you know, impressive, like 92, didn't have a lot of movement to it or whatever. I understand that that's a prospect and long term, and the Orioles will surely turn him into the next Kyle Bradish or something like that. But yeah, I don't know. I was a little underwhelmed. Maybe that's just because the Jays haven't scored on a lot of guys, and they scored on him pretty easily there, but not in the first inning, which of course will is something we'll be keeping an eye on again in this series. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll tee this series up. Chris Bassitt against Hogan Harris tonight. Kevin Gausman against Luis Medina on Saturday. A TBA for the Blue Jays against Mitch Spence on Sunday. It is also reverse boycott night down at the Oakland Coliseum. We'll talk more about that. We'll explain to you how the Oakland baseball community is pushing back against what John Fisher is doing there with Melissa Lockard of The Athletic. When we come back, and Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays down in Oakland tonight, where the fan base and the baseball community has been treated very, very poorly over the years by owner John Fisher. The team is moving to Sacramento temporarily. They are planning to move to Vegas, but there are complications there, and they want to play neutral site games. It's a whole mess. Let's check in on that with senior editor and staff writer at The Athletic, Melissa Lockard. She joins us now. Melissa, thank you for doing this. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. So tonight is reverse boycott night, FJ Fisher Fest, last dive party, pre-party, and all that stuff. How big a night is this for the Oakland baseball community to kind of voice this displeasure that not even bubbled up? It's been bubbling over for a long time now. But how big a night is this for, athletics aside, the Oakland baseball community?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it'll have the same intensity and draw as the ones that you saw last year. I think that was something that, it was new. It was something that maybe they felt like could change. I think now there's sort of a sense that the inevitable is coming. So I think you'll probably see the bigger outpouring in the last series of the season, obviously, in the last games at the Coliseum. However, I do think it's going to be a pretty good crowd, especially compared to the crowds they've been drawing this year. It's also a fireworks night and everything as well. But the anger is pretty palpable, and I think you're going to hear a lot of it tonight.
Yeah, sell flags on the highway, sell the team chants, obviously, at games and things like that. Yeah, and I mean, it is kind of cool that the last dive bar party of it all, like there's going to be live music in the parking lot before the game and stuff. Like in a downtime, I really appreciate that the baseball fans and the baseball community has been able to have some fun and a lot of spirit about this, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually bringing my two sons there as fans tonight just to enjoy the atmosphere. They're a fantastic group. The Oakland 68s also that work with them are really fun. They make it, it's not somber, you know, it's a party. It's a celebration of everything that has happened in the, 60 years that the A's have been in Oakland. And what can continue with that community even when they leave. So, tailgates have been a huge part of the A's culture since they've moved to Oakland. And I think that will continue in whatever sports that continue in this area.
So in terms of what is actually happening with the team, I know this is something you guys have covered very, very well at The Athletic. You tweet about it pretty regularly. John Fisher trying to move this team to Sacramento, to a ballpark that is not a major league ballpark, without a clear plan of action for Vegas. You tweeted something a couple weeks ago that I thought summed it all up, which is that, yeah, contraction doesn't make business sense, but neither does anything about this process. Where are we in the process of this? And like, is there any sort of clarity on what the future of the A's is going to look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's a vote coming up in the Nevada State Legislature that has to move forward, the funding that they had approved that John Fisher is really relying on in order to be able to fund that stadium in Las Vegas. There's been some controversy in the last week or so that apparently the team has requested to be able to play, I think it was up to 8 games originally, now I've seen 7, but some games away from Las Vegas and neutral sites is a way to kind of, they claim, build the brand expand and draw more players. And, you know, the way the funding was supposed to work with the bonds and the tax revenue that they were going to get from the games that were being played there, you know, Las Vegas and Nevada was really relying on sellouts almost for every single game, which is absurd also. Like, you know, even the Yankees don't draw sellouts every game. But to take seven out of the pot to, you know, all together from the beginning would make that almost impossible to reach the bond, you know, projections that they had given. So now all of a sudden you're seeing some grumblings on that side. Who knows what's going to happen there? But then you have in Sacramento, the owner of the Sacramento Kings, you know, offering up, he also owns the AAA Sacramento Rivercats, you know, offering up his stadium for free for them to play in for X number of years. And there's never been anything free that I think John Fisher hasn't turned down. So they're going to be there. And, you know, I mean, obviously the Blue Jays have some experience with having to play in minor league parks for a year. That was a very different circumstance. But I can only imagine what would have happened to the franchise had that been an indefinite sort of situation as opposed to something that was very specifically related to one period of time, you know, and in a global pandemic. So I think this is going to create a lot of issues for trying to build a team for the next 4 years. You know, it's going to be very difficult, I think, to try to draw players, even players from the Sacramento area, I would think, would have a tough time, you know, wanting to go and play in a AAA park as a big leaguer for, you know, 4 or 5 years at a time.
And so, okay, so John Fisher has owned this team at least in part since 2005 and, you know, has owned an even larger share of it the last couple of years. The A's have now the Moneyball. A's were a little before this. That was kind of 2000 to 2003. But they have had a little bit of success. They've had two separate runs of three playoff seasons in a row since then. But if I am understanding the coverage of this team over the years correctly, that is in spite of John Fisher. He's invested very obviously very little in the stadium, little in the, you know, Moneyball makes it seem like it's this aspirational thing sometimes to have to do it on a shoestring budget, but it really hasn't been that. What has his impact on this franchise been over the last 20 years from a competitive standpoint?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to even quantify it because he just basically was a non-existent entity for a lot of those years. You know, Lou Wolf was the face of the ownership group for the beginning of it. And, you know, he was the one that was sort of out there, you know, trying to get the new stadiums and the various iterations of that they tried to get. He was the one that was at the stadium. It was doing the media availability. And so you never heard from John Fisher. He was kind of the man behind the curtain for a long time. And then recently you've only heard from him because he's got something that he needs to, you know, really secure. And they weren't going to let him kind of get away with not meeting with any media at all in trying to get this funding in Nevada. But there's not a lot we know about him. You know, I think it's pretty clear that there has not been a big financial investment in the team. There's been moments in time where a little bit more money could have extended a, you know, competition window well beyond the 3 years that you saw in 2012 through 2014, you know, and then again in 2018 through 2020. Obviously, the Blue Jays benefited both times when they decided to pull back and, you know, getting Josh Donaldson and Marcus Semien, right? But, I think it's just a situation where it's a total lack of energy, a lack of caring. The Coliseum itself, you know, like there was very little that was done. There were sort of little spurts at times where they'd add like a barbecue terrace or they'd do whatever. But like the building itself has sort of been allowed to fall into disrepair. And it didn't need a ton of work to at least still be a working building, right? Like it's not going to be, you know, the most beautiful building in baseball, but it's certainly not like it's going to fall apart on you if you put a little care in. So, and they've never done any aggressive media marketing either. The best commercials were during that Moneyball period, and that was during the Schott Hoffman era. I think you can just see from all of that that it's been in spite of him rather than because of him.
And it's unfortunate because, you know, this is a team that when they've been good, like Oakland has a very rich baseball history and a strong baseball community there. They've drawn over 2 million in attendance multiple times, right? It's not like nobody shows up in good times. It's only these last couple years where they've been basically told, don't bother showing up, where the attendance has really fallen. I wanted to ask you about something else in the Oakland baseball community to do something a little more positive with this segment. You wrote recently, so the Oakland Ballers are a new team in the Pioneer League. The Pioneer League expanded this year, and it used to be an official minor league. Now it's an independent MLB partner league. Kelsey Whitmore became the first woman to play in Pioneer League games and then the first woman to start a Pioneer League game the other day. How has the Oakland Ballers launch been, and how cool is that Kelsey Whitmore story?
Yeah, I mean, I think both are super cool. You know, it's a real inspiring story. Basically, two guys that grew up A's fans decided when the team was going to leave that they wanted to create a new baseball tradition in Oakland. And, you know, unlike John Fisher, they put themselves out there. They put their money out there. They put their energy. They took this historic ballpark that used to be a place where like amateur players like Kurt Flood played as high schoolers and renovated it in incredibly record-breaking time to open this stadium on Tuesday for 4,200 people. It was a sellout on opening night on Tuesday. Last night, Kelsey Whitmore threw three innings as the first woman to ever start a game in the Pioneer League. And it's a league that's existed since 1939. So this is a long time, including back when, you know, all the men were off at war and the women were playing professional baseball. So it's a pretty cool thing. The energy is great. The groups that you talked about, the Last Dive Bar and the Oakland 68s have been really instrumental in bringing a lot of fans there. And it's an area of Oakland and West Oakland that's needed some energy and renovation into it. And the neighborhood's, I think, seeing some really good benefits from it. So, you know, it's one of those happy stories. It's not going to replace the Oakland A's, but it's something that gives people something to look forward to in the community and to come together and celebrate. So I think it's great. And Kelsey is really inspiring. I got a chance to talk to her when she signed. And, you know, here's somebody who she was the first woman to play in the Atlantic League, which is like, I think, the premier independent league. She was a star softball player. Like, she's just a ball of energy. She's somebody who you can really look up to. If you've got a girl that plays baseball, she's really somebody to admire. So it's great to see her out there doing this.
And on top of all this, despite that park only holding 4,200 people, they have in that last game, they outdrew 10 Oakland A's home games this year, which is pretty entertaining. With this actual A's team, there are some things to be... I know fans have not wanted to go out and they don't want to support John Fisher and things like that. There's still a team. People still like baseball, and the players on the field aren't responsible for that. So let's talk about what's happened with the actual team this year. Some positives there. Mason Miller, obviously incredible. And then Austin Adams, Danny Jimenez, Scott Alexander behind him. This is like... despite things not going all that well, like a top five bullpen in baseball. What have you made of the Mason Miller experience and that group's ability overall?
Yeah, I mean, Mason's just a ton of fun. I mean, you know, here's a guy, soft-spoken, but like a huge mountain of a man, right? Like, and then gets out there, throws 102, 103, like it's nothing. You know, throws a slider or just to be kind of mean because you can't catch up to the fastball. So he's going to, you know, take it easy on you at 89, but the ball disappears. It's been a great story to see him. You know, he's a starter, and they threw him into this job because they needed to monitor his innings because he's had some injury stuff, and he's taken right to it. I mean, to go in and go against the Yankees at Yankee Stadium and mow through their best three hitters and get a save, like, you know, it's pretty incredible to see a rookie, you know, doing that kind of thing. So he's been fantastic. And, you know, the pitching staff got off to a great start, and like the entire rotation, except for JP Sears, who pitched last night, is on the injured list. So, nobody's going to whine about injuries. I know very well how much the Blue Jays have been dealing with that too, but that's hurt them recently. And Lucas Erceg was another reliever that was off to a really great start. He's currently on the IL, but the pitching has been much better than it was last year, and that's allowed them to be a lot more competitive despite the fact that the offense has been struggling. They just got Miguel Andujar back from the injured list, and he had such a great spring, and it was really kind of disappointing to see him not be able to get started at the beginning of the season, but he's someone who's looked pretty good since he came off the injured list as well.
You mentioned all the starting rotation injuries, and the list is long. Like Paul Blackburn, our old friend Ross Stripling, Ken Walichuk, Alex Wood, like it is like four-fifths of the rotation are hurt here. I know you do a lot of prospect stuff, not just with the A's, in MLB in general. I guess the one nice thing is then you get to see some of these guys maybe a little sooner than you would have expected, a little more of them. I know Hogan Harris is a little older, he's 27, but we're going to see him and Luis Medina and Mitch Spence in this series based on the probable pitchers. Small samples for all of them so far, but it doesn't seem like, especially with Spence, who's like had a good bit of run here. What can you tell us about those three, and you know, the fact that it has gone, you know, better than maybe you would have expected, calling three guys up earlier from the minors than you'd maybe planned?
Yeah, you know, Hogan got some experience last year when they had similar kind of injury issues, was sort of rushed up a little bit, I think. He had his own injury issues for his first 3 years of his career, so it was really kind of exciting to see him break through and finally actually get to the big leagues. You know, left-hander moves the ball around well, can miss a lot of bats. He can get a little control issues at times, but when he's on, he's very tough to hit. And he's the guy that pitched in the reverse boycott last year, so it's sort of funny that he's getting the start tonight. And then, you know, Luis Medina, he started the year on the injured list. He hurt his knee during spring training, but you know, he's a guy they were really excited about in the spring before the injury. He can throw, you know, 100 miles an hour pretty easily as well. I think, you know, a guy that probably a lot of teams pegged as a reliever, but his control took a step forward last year. Still needs to kind of take another step forward to probably stay in that role forever, but he's made progress. And, you know, if you throw 102 and can locate it a little bit, they're going to give you that shot. So he pitched really well in his season debut, and we'll see kind of see what he can do this one. And Mitch Spence, you know, he was their Rule 5 pick. It's actually funny that Medina and Spence were both Yankee farmhands originally. But you know, he's a guy that was in the bullpen as sort of a long reliever, did a really great job in that, and then just sort of had to kind of step in and stretch out as a starter the last few times through, and has done a great job. You know, I don't think he's going to overpower anybody, but you know, he's somebody who keeps the ball, you know, in the ballpark and gives his defense a chance to make plays. So I think that's what you'll kind of see from them in this situation.
I have to ask you this one because it is a Canadian show. Abraham Toro having kind of a career year here. I know it wasn't seen as like the hugest addition, kind of like a minor league shuffling with the Brewers last year, and he'd been up with the Mariners before and the Astros and never really stuck. What have you seen in Abraham Toro kind of finally looking like a full-time major leaguer? Is just a product of regular opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's a great hitter. I don't know, like, you know, all the different circumstances behind the opportunities that he got before. You know, defensively, maybe if he was like a little stronger with the glove, maybe he would have gotten a longer run with some of those teams. But he really knows how to hit. You know, he moves the ball over the field. He makes good contact. He takes strong at bats. He's a guy you can put at the top of the order, even though he's not a speedster, because he's gonna, you know, really work the pitcher at the beginning of a game. So he's been great, and he's, you know, he's a really good veteran presence in the clubhouse as well. Speaks a million languages, right? Like, I just think, you know, he's a fun guy to have on the team, and you know, I think he's found a really nice home there.
It's great. It's nice for us to see as well. Here's the other weird thing about the A's, I find, is anytime their guys get good, at least the last couple of years, it's immediately like, okay, well, who's going to get sold at the trade deadline? And you mentioned it, the Jays have benefited. There was the Josh Donaldson, Matt Chapman, Semien walking as a free agent, looking for a 1 year deal. I'm not suggesting necessarily for the Blue Jays, but it's also, it can get a little hard to figure out because, like, almost nobody on this team makes money or has, like they have a couple pending free agents, but they're not, like, they're all in the IL for the most part, or you know, just aren't that relevant or whatever. I assume the A's will kind of sell whoever has a market for them. Is that kind of what your read would be come July with this team? Other than maybe Mason Miller, I guess.
You know, it is hard to tell, because, like, if they're serious about trying to actually, you know, do something competitive leading into this, like, Vegas thing, you know, most of the guys have 4 or 5 years of team control left. None of them are expensive, as you say. So there really isn't any reason to trade them. Like, they're not blocking players they need to bring up and give a shot at the big league level. You know, maybe they'll trade some. I saw JP Sears was coming up in trade talks, you know, with other teams, and you can see why, because he's just a durable lefty that, you know, is aggressive and can pitch deep into games pretty consistently. So, you know, maybe you see a move like that. I'd be surprised if they trade Mason Miller, just because, like, you don't get arms like that very often, and you know, the chance to develop him maybe even as a starter again, but over the next few years at the cost that he is right now, you know, unless you're given a package of players that you just absolutely can't turn down. But you know, someone like Sears, someone maybe like Brent Rooker, who obviously would do a lot for offenses. There's several contending teams right now that might need a DH that's a little more consistent than what they've seen. You know, I could see maybe a move like that, but it is really hard to tell exactly what they would do. You know, they only sort of traded a little bit on the margins last year in sort of a similar situation. Although they do have more players, I think that would be attractive to teams than last year.
Especially if a couple of them can can get healthy. The Mason Miller one's fascinating. Like, you know, most teams, it's like, okay, well, you've got like 5 more years of control. Why would you think this? And like you mentioned, you could turn him back into a starter and then the value would be even higher. But who knows what this team is the question. Melissa, thank you for taking the time out today. Enjoy the reverse boycott and the last dive bar pre-party and everything today. It sounds like a lot of fun.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Melissa Lockard of The Athletic, senior editor and staff writer there. Yeah, should be a fun energy around this game tonight. It goes at 9:40. Chris Bassett against Hogan Harris. We'll give you a little on Hogan Harris in a moment here. Rest of the series, Saturday and Sunday, are both 4:07 starts. It'll be Kevin Gausman against Luis Medina, and then the Jays, what we presume is a bullpen day, against Mitch Spence. We'll have all of those for you on Sportsnet. It's Dan, Joe, and Arden on the broadcast. Brad and Caleb for you for Blue Jay Central. Ben Schulman back in the radio chair, feeling a little better now, so he'll be with you with Chris LaRue, and then Shai Davidi is down there for us as well on the sportsnet.ca side. So should be a fun one. Obviously, the stakes here are the Jays could get on a winning streak for the first time this season, and the Jays could get back above 500 for the first time since like the third week in April. And I know those are low bars, but that's where they've lowered it so far this season, and that's where they have to climb back from. So you would still absolutely take it. You would take sweeping the Oakland Athletics at this point and call it a win. So they'll have to do that first against Hogan Harris, who is, not the most imposing of pitchers you're going to face. 27-year-old lefty. He does have a 3.14 ERA in 14 innings this year and some decent underlying metrics, but he had a 7.67 ERA in AAA before he got called up. He had a 7.14 ERA in 63 major league innings last year. He walks a lot of guys. 17% walk rate in AAA, double digits through most of the minors. He can miss bats like he has, and this is kind of, you know, you hope if you're Oakland that he can be effectively wild. He'll miss some bats, but he's out of the zone a lot. And for a team that generally, and I know some people get annoyed at the swing decision stuff and the patient stuff if it's not leading to damage, you know, this is a Blue Jays team that should do well with that kind of guy. Cade Povich yesterday profiled similarly in terms of, yeah, it's solid stuff, but you are outside of the strike zone a little too much. The Jays worked a handful of walks and did so effectively against Povich. That's probably what they're looking to do against Hogan Harris. He'll throw 94. He throws it mostly up and into righties. There are decent results on the fastball, but it's really the curveball changeup combination where he succeeds. He'll throw curveball slider to lefties, curveball changeup to righties. The curveball has been his best pitch historically in the minor leagues, both for batted ball results and for getting swing and miss. The changeup has been solid this year, but it was pretty bad last year. So maybe he's made improvements on it. Maybe it's just noisy. We'll see. The Jays have seen him. He pitched against them. He started against them in June last year, gave up 4 earned runs in 4 2/3 innings, walked 4 guys and struck out 6. So that's kind of what we're talking about. Danny Jansen took him for a homer. IKF has faced him in the past and has also homered against them. Jays as a group, 4 for 14, plus a pair of walks and those 2 home runs against Hogan Harris historically. So you certainly hope that that's a guy that you can keep the bats rolling against and score a run in the first inning for the first time since May 4th. It's been a minute. On the other side, Chris Bassett will start. He's had a couple good ones in a row. He gutted out those 2 starts against the White Sox. And yeah, it's the White Sox, but those were starts where Chris Bassett arguably could have been on the IL for those through 12 shutout innings across those 2 starts. He did give up 3 against the Pirates last time, but struck out 7. The stuff looked pretty good. He's now down to a 4.13 ERA on the season with underlying numbers that mostly line up with that. So not too bad. He's probably a little better than a 4.13 ERA guy, but he's gotten back after that slower start this season. You know the deal with Bassett. 8 pitches that he'll throw. He throws all of them at least 4% of the time. You're looking sinker, cutter, curveball. So relevant to our conversation with Justin Choi earlier, leading sinker and cutter, and then going to an army of breaking balls, curveball, sweeper, changeup, slider, splitter, and then a 4-seam fastball every once in a while. Bassett is still dealing with these pretty massive platoon splits on the season. Lefties have a 900 OPS and 6 home runs against them. Righties have a 592 OPS and just 1 home run against them. So big splits there. Oakland has 5 lefties/switch hitters that they could put in the lineup here. I would anticipate them doing so. They become almost a league average offense against righties when we control for the fact that their ballpark doesn't play very friendly to hitters. So I'm not saying this is a team that's going to go gangbusters against Chris Bassitt from the left side, but they do hit righties a little better than lefties. He has faced them a bunch, 45 plate appearances sprinkled over that lineup, 262 average and 381 slugging against them, 27% striker rate. So solid results, nothing spectacular. JJ Bleday has homered off of them. Zach Gelof and Seth Brown have good results against them. Everyone else is kind of bad in a small sample. This is an A's team that is not particularly good. They have allowed the third most and the fourth highest OPS in first innings. They're 25 and 39 with a minus 67 run differential. Bottom three offense, bottom 10 pitching staff. They do have a really good bullpen, though, so you want to get to these starters. In addition to Miller, they have a couple other arms back there. Austin Adams, some lefties who can get you out. So you do want to do the damage early. That has been a challenge for the Blue Jays. We'll see if they can do it against the A's. We'll see if when we talk to you Monday, the Blue Jays will be back above 500 and on their first five-game winning streak of the season. It would make for a fun Monday show. This has been a fun Friday show. Thank you to Keegan Matheson, Justin Choi, Pat Malacaro, and Melissa Lockhart for coming on. Thanks to Lindsay Dunn for letting us use that Lisa Loeb clip. Thanks to Lance Kennedy, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. As always, thank you to you. Hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we will talk to you when Jays Talk Plus returns Monday at 10 a.m., hopefully talking five-game winning streak.